This is Jane Poulin with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I'm interviewing James Croker, the Chief Accountant of the Securities and Exchange Commission. We have a few people present in the meeting. We'll introduce ourselves, but before we get started, just want to make sure, Jim, you're familiar with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. You understand that our mission is to investigate the financial crisis. And we invited you here today for this interview so we could just talk about the role of accounting during the financial crisis. I have some things in mind that I want to make sure that we cover, but I also want to make sure that we kind of throw the topic open for you so that you can tell us what your thoughts are. I had teed up a few topics for you in advance. I want to make sure we touch on those, and then we'll be off. If we could just go around the room. I'm Jane Poulin.
Jeff Smith with the FCIC.
Jeff Minton from the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Jim Croker.
Sam Forstein, SEC.
Randall Dodd, the FCIC.
And Greg Feldberg just joined us. And Jim, before we start, if you could just give us your background, brief overview of your education and work history, that'd be great for the record.
Yeah, I graduated with a degree in accounting from the University of Nebraska, or a degree in business with an emphasis in accounting, joined Deloitte & Touche at the time in the Nebraska practice or the Omaha practice. Worked there as passed the CPA exam, so I'm continue to be a licensed CPA. Worked in the Omaha office on a number of large public companies. Surprisingly, Deloitte has a number of large public companies, or did at the time, in their Omaha practice. Worked there for about 5 years and then joined Deloitte's national office as what they call in their management development program. It's a two-year assignment where you focus on one of several technical venues. I happened to join their accounting group. So from Omaha to Deloitte's national office, started focusing on revenue recognition, accounting issues, stock compensation. A lot of the things that happened to be fairly topical in the late 90s to early 2000s. After the end of my two-year assignment at Deloitte, I joined the Financial Accounting Standards Board as a practice fellow or an accounting fellow. It's a program they run where they have, at the time, one accounting fellow from each of, there were five large accounting firms at the time, so generally one from each of the five large accounting firms. And maybe one from industry or one from a smaller firm. It's another two-year assignment. Leaving there, I went back to Deloitte's national office as a senior manager and then shortly thereafter as a partner, where I was in their accounting consulting group, so accounting or consulting with engagement teams on complex accounting transactions, again, things like revenue recognition, stock compensation, restructuring charges, and moved into their standard setting and communications group, the group that has inside Deloitte as a structure oversight of responding to FASB comment or FASB proposals, working with the Emerging Issues Task Force, issuing guidance to practice. Deloitte at the time and continues to have an accounting manual where they express their own views on accounting topics as part of the responsibilities in my group. Left there in 2007, January 2007, to join the SEC as a deputy chief accountant in the accounting group. In the accounting group, there are three deputies, one that has oversight of accounting matters, so FASB standards, when there's issues in practice, consulting with CorpFin or enforcement on the appropriate application of U.S. GAAP. There's a deputy that has oversight of auditing or professional practice group matters, as well as an international deputy. After serving in that role for, I guess, just about 2 years, the then chief accountant, Conrad Hewitt, retired. And I took at the request of the then chairman, Chris Cox, took the role of acting chief accountant, which I held for about 9 months, and was appointed as chief accountant in late August or early September of last year.
Okay, great. So with that, happy to go in any direction you'd like. If you have some...
And if you just want to talk generally about the role of accounting in the financial crisis,
and then we can drill into any topics that are, you think are either you think are really relevant, or I will probably have some follow-up questions.
Okay. I mean, I'll just highlight two areas that I think make sense to delve into in a little bit more depth, and obviously anything else that you're interested in. But the two broad areas that come to my mind when you think about, did accounting play a role in either helping identify the crisis, or did it play a role in making, either exaggerating or making worse the crisis? The first two things that come to my mind are the role of accounting for financial instruments, which people lovingly refer to as fair value accounting.
Or mark-to-market.
Or mark-to-market.
If they like it even more.
Yeah, if they market it, like it even more, it's mark-to-market accounting. And the second broad area that, you know, immediately comes to mind is another term that's about as sweeping, which is off-balance sheet accounting. You know, a general reference to, are your risk exposures shown on the balance sheet, or are they shown in some other manner, either off-balance sheet or on a net basis? Let me start with, you know, either the role of fair value in accounting for financial instruments, because it was the topic that I think got them, at least initially, the most focus on, was so-called fair value accounting playing a role in exaggerating, or at least in some people's, or that might be in some people's minds, and others, you know, I think have gone further and said, well, fair value accounting was effectively the cause of the financial crisis. I take a different perspective. I actually think that, one, it's important for me to put in context where fair value is actually used in financial reporting today. And so it's used for instruments that are traded. So if you plan to actually access the market, you're not going to hold the instrument till its maturity, or you're not holding it for some longer period of time. Obviously, as you know, that fair value is required there. It's required for derivative instruments, although to the extent that they serve as an effective hedge, the other side is also fair valued, or there's some adjustment in the income statement for that. And then it also is used for instruments that you don't know whether you're hold to maturity, so they are available for sale, kind of in accounting speak, but the fair value changes don't actually run through the income statement. So I think, one, it's important to put in context that the guidance around fair value has been relatively unchanged for long periods of time. Probably the most current change to at least where you're required to use fair value is derivatives, and then smaller pieces of, you know, I'll call like cats and dogs issues, using fair value for viatical life insurance settlements, which isn't really the crisis issue.
Yeah, that's a little beyond our scope.
Yeah.
But basically, we've got the 115 securities with the three different categories.
Right, and then 133 with derivatives, which are, again, 115 was early 90s, and 133 was late 90s, effective for early 2000. FASB issued guidance, and this is the guidance that got a lot of folks' attention, Statement 157. And this is all covered at length in our study on fair value accounting, but, you know, 157 dealt with practices in how to determine fair value, but didn't tell you where you needed to use fair value.
So it didn't change where fair value was required.
Well, yeah.
It just provided
some guidelines to use fair value,
tweaks to the methodologies that have been followed in the past.
If you're required to use fair value, here are, in some cases, what people were doing as best practices potentially were codified as, you must do these things. It must be an exit price notion, that is, the price that you could transact for today, not pejoratively, not the price you wish it would sell for today, or the price that you could get if, in fact, you held this thing for 5 years and you know, hope that the market recovers. So my perspective is that fair value is actually useful in identifying the crisis earlier on, at least with respect to, again, securities that are being traded, as opposed to what may have happened in some earlier crises of a failure to recognize that there was an issue in hope that the market would turn around. And actually saw it in the Japanese financial crisis, of whether that actually made things worse because of people's fear of other companies' balance sheets and inability to actually transact or sell assets, because you would at that point, I think every accounting model is premised on, once you sell an asset, you recognize the loss. Mm-hmm. That it actually gave people the flexibility in those categories to free up their balance sheet and be transparent about the value of securities. So that isn't to say that there were very real questions about how to determine fair value. The guidance in Statement 157 was written at a time period where there was extremely high liquidity and very low premiums for liquidity. The notion in Statement 157 was that it's a willing buyer, willing seller notion premised on a price that you would receive in a market that was relatively active, that you're not trying to replicate the price that you would get when a sale was a forced or liquidation sale. You know, when you turn that around and then come into a market where there is much less liquidity, at least in some cases, people selling assets, you know, in very short time periods, raised to me legitimate probably some questions that aren't as legitimate and some questions that are very legitimate of how do I determine when there's a very, very low trading volume and prices look dislocated from what any reasonable person would think are the fundamentals of an asset, how much reliance do I place? And I think this is why many people call it mark to market,
right,
is how much reliance do I place on that?
So just to be clear, so we have, for example, in 157, we think of the three different levels of valuation, levels 1, 2, and 3. Level 1 would be active liquid market, price times quantity. Levels 2 and 3, you've got less objective evidence as you move down that, down through those layers. And when you're in level 3, really marking to model more. But just to be clear, 157 didn't introduce those concepts.
That's
those
right.
Concepts were present before 157. So as we went into the financial crisis, some of what I heard or I think I'm hearing from people is just what you say, that either mark-to-market accounting caused or exacerbated the crisis, and it sounds like companies were taking marks based on trades in the marketplace that they felt in their heart of hearts were not representative of fair value, but somehow they felt constrained by 157 because, depending on how you read FAS 157, some might have viewed as price times quantity as being the preeminent way to value. And when you don't have that, then you move into these other methodologies. And was there perhaps too much emphasis in people's minds that they should be relying more on price times quantity, and therefore they felt somehow hamstrung to look at the trades in the market, even though they felt they weren't really representative?
So to me, that's a very difficult issue to get to the bottom of, because I've heard the same anecdotal mm-hmm. situations or stories where somebody says, I'm being forced to mark to a price that can't even come close to reflecting
reality. Right.
And the more and more you've heard that is, you know, we would respond with, if that's not the objective of 157, it's not to come up with a value that doesn't reflect what a market participant would transact at. You know, so you hear that, and my response, and many in our office, was please bring us those fact patterns, because we'd like to understand that. And I'm not saying it didn't happen, but help us understand at a more granular level. So sorting out those who were complaining about not wanting to recognize a real decline in value from those that had real concerns about, am I marking to an appropriate level?
Right.
It's
am
pretty
I applying
difficult.
The
you know, which
correctly?
Am I applying it correctly?
Right.
And so throughout the crisis, there were a number of dialogues with the largest accounting firms, questions about were they rigidly or overly overly relying on the observable market data where it was clear that that market data wasn't reflective of reality. Starting in, I'm trying to think of the time period, it was maybe the August of 07, August or September of 07 time period, when the very beginnings of what people think of, I think, as the crisis started to emerge, of talking to the large accounting firms, the large banks about, here's what 157 does and here's what 157 doesn't. require. And of course, at that point, people were saying, many people were saying, well, none of these instruments, the instruments are all money good, so why is it we're, you know, chasing this irrational market, which is, you know, over time you realize, well, maybe the instruments weren't near as good as people optimistically thought they were. So there is this kind of continuing, I don't know what the right word is, but this continuing message that you would hear is the market's overreacting,
right?
Only to realize, you know, some few months later that no, maybe the market was closer to, you know, ultimate collectability of cash flows than at least some of the most optimistic people might have been in the crisis, of saying, look, there's no way this could eat into, you know, a senior tranche of a securitization, yet seeing that default rates actually got to that point where there were real cash flow losses.
So you heard the same types of things during the crisis that I'm hearing now in retrospect, that we were forced to take marks that weren't realistic. The auditors perhaps were being too tied to price times quantity, making us take marks that we didn't think were realistic. But you never actually saw any real live fact patterns that came to you that led you to believe.
Yeah, please bring in a preclearance, because it's
right.
Not the objective, and you're familiar with the preclearance
right.
process,
yeah.
But basically consult with the SEC, because if you're being forced to take marks that aren't reasonable, that isn't the objective of the standard. We had similar discussions with the PCAOB mm-hmm. of if you're seeing this in your review of audits, or auditors are feeling like because of the potential for PCAOB review that they now have to anchor themselves
right.
to something that's observable but not, you know, not as relevant. That's not the objective. I think continuing then, you know, starting in 2007, but 2008 in September of that year, the SEC issuing a number of Q&As that reiterated the objective isn't to replicate a distressed sale or a fire sale, all the way to the point where the FASB in, what was it, April of 2009, issues.
There were a couple of different. You had letters, and then the FASB issued a couple of different pieces of guidance. One case seemed like it was clarification, and another case we actually changed the model for impairments. Which
so that was a change,
yeah,
but the other seems more interpretive or
right.
you know, clarifying. How do you come up with, you know, the best estimate of fair value? And I don't. To be fair. I think, again, 157 was written in an environment where there was extremely high levels of liquidity. So it's effectively, not that the concepts were new, but you're testing, you know, language that people are looking at with, you know, basically under a microscope in one of the most challenging market environments to actually sort out, is it really an irrational price and so I shouldn't be using it, or is it really that there's such either a lack of information about the underlying cash flows of the security that a willing buyer and willing seller really are saying it's, you know, whatever the number is, 20 cents, 30 cents, 40 cents on the dollar, and helping divide that line where you should move from there is some observable information but it's not particularly relevant. That's not an easy issue.
Yeah. Okay. So the other thing is, other than temporary impairments seem to have been a big deal, and that has a fair value play on it. But I'm trying to understand, was...
Jane, before you go to the next point, can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
You seem to be implicitly saying that, you know, when FASB 157 was written, they didn't really anticipate the consequences of how this would inform people's decisions during a crisis situation.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to say that they didn't think about it, but it's the first time the new standard is being tested, and it's about the deepest crisis in, you know, three quarters of a century. So, and I don't think it's at all that the concepts didn't prove out to be reasonable in terms of the idea, but the idea that you might also need some reinforcing, or this is what we meant when we said you don't replicate a distressed sale, and helping you divine then with now real evidence of here's when a sale might be distressed and here's when a sale, you know, might actually be a price you don't like, but the fact that market participants are transacting at that volume kind of tells you it's a reasonable reasonable price.
Well, because this, just to be clear, fair value has been required all along. There were some modifications to fair value under 157. There was additional transparency of the different levels. But 157, the first time that that level of information about how people are to do fair value accounting when it's required, that's the first time it was present in the marketplace. And then it was had an effective date of January 1, 2008, but a lot of financial institutions adopted January 1, 2007, or the beginning of their fiscal year 2007. So what happened is you have this new rule that's out there with new language. It's the first time language on this topic has been issued by the accounting standards that are except for...
To this level of detail.
This level of detail, yeah. And it's out there in the marketplace during a time when there's a lot of pressure in the marketplace. And
some of it very real, and some of that pressure of people not yet wanting to, you know, holding out hope that the market turns around before it's, you know, time to do reporting. So it's just a challenging environment to have that new standard.
Absolutely. And when if I recall what I thought when I read through it, it's like it's not as though they didn't envision there being illiquid markets and difficulties in pricing, but it seemed to always be. Afterthought, maybe not be quite fair, but it didn't seem to, you know, it did seem, as you're saying, the thrust of it, the thinking reflected, like, in a normal market, this is how we're going to do it. And hence not addressing with the same degree of thoroughness what one would be doing during a abnormal or malfunctioning period.
So I think it's fair to say that, given the depth of the crisis, the issues of, you know, the very real, here's a transaction, how do I sort through, you know, where am I at in the buckets that Jane described, that was part of, you know, what people I think were living through real time, is I now have real information and your standard doesn't, you know, deal directly with my fact pattern, help me out. So I think it is fair to say.
Yeah, because we had benchmarks went pear-shaped with the LIBOR even, and then you got distressed prices or no prices. And so even if there's no market prices hardly, even the benchmarks don't seem to be behaving properly, so even your mark to model's not, and then also the models themselves were being called into question in terms of some of the models for calculating the value of structured securities that relied on a lot of correlation estimates. Mm-hmm. So with a questioned model, a questioned benchmark, and no market prices, then it seems...
Yeah, and I'm not.
It wasn't in, you know, you don't have a level four.
Right. And I'm not trying in any way to say that I think fair value is a panacea to financial reporting, which is why I kind of started with the, you know, keep in context where it's used. It's used for instruments that are either, you know, derivative instruments where it's hard to think of, even with all of the challenges of coming up with an estimate, it's hard to think of a model that results in anything that's decision useful other than some estimate of what the instrument is worth today, or trading securities where people are saying my purpose for investing in these is flipping them or I'm not holding them for long term.
So then if you're in, and this is one of the things I wanted to talk about, is do you really think it was about the trading book, or is it more the other than temporary impairments that people were having all the concern with? Because one of the things I thought about is, if it's all about fair value accounting and that was a cause or an exacerbation of the crisis, why is that? Because these are big financial institutions. Those assets and the derivative liabilities that are on their books, they're trading those actively. They have to price those not every quarter when they report them on the financial statements, which are then dated by 40 to 60 days when they're filed. They have to deal with the value of those on a daily basis, and they're managing their business every day, and the liquidity of that business every day. So,
and that's not about accounting. I mean, there's obviously, as you know, no accounting requirement to mark your books on a daily basis.
So if you're talking about the trading book, if there's pressures on the value in the trading book, I don't know how that is so directly linked to fair value accounting. Maybe it is because you might have an eye towards what's my regulatory capital, or what capital information do I want presented into the marketplace when I file my Q, whenever the next Q is. So maybe there's an impact because you're deciding what kind of trades to make, what amount to trade. But then the other than temporary impairment seems to have a bigger impact, if you will, if your eye is towards capital and what that's going to look like at quarter end, because the trades happen daily, you have some visibility into that kind of pricing. The other than temporary impairments, you may not know, because some of these are model dependent, you may not know even on the day you close your quarter what that other than temporary impairment charge is going to be, because it's right. time consuming. And because of that, I'm wondering, do you think that companies were delevering more than they might have because they just didn't have the visibility on what those other than temporary impairments might look like?
I don't know the answer to whether companies were delevering more because of that. Well, start with other than temporary impairment accounting has been a struggle in accounting circles probably for as long as the words other than temporary impairment have existed, because the notion is for those securities that you hold at cost or you mark them down to fair value but you don't report the loss in income until it's other than temporarily impaired, you then have to define what does other than temporarily impaired mean. And so there's enforcement cases, you know, dating back probably a decade or more, saying the notion isn't, longer than a decade now, probably two decades, the notion isn't you write something down if there's no chance that you'll ever recover it. So it isn't if it's permanently impaired, you write it down. It's if you don't expect to the security to recover in some reasonable period of time, and all kind of folklore about whether that's 9 months to 12 months. A whole FASB EITF project dedicated to this, and then a series of potential FASB staff positions that would help people understand when is something other than temporarily impaired, with the notion that it's you've got to have objective evidence that says the security will recover. Of course, if you have objective evidence that says the security will recover, you know, you hear some accountants say, why are you an accountant? Maybe you ought to get out of accounting and go buy these securities.
Well, if the market itself was malfunctioning, think of the flash plunge or something on May 6th, or if you could cite some thing not related to the value of the security but to the condition of the market,
right.
You could say it was a temporary.
And there's a number of those that are cited that these might be real. But it's a challenging notion that hasn't, I would say that it effectively ends up operationalizing itself in practice something like follows. If the security is, you know, highly rated, it's, you know, kind of plain vanilla debt-like looking, other than temporary impairment doesn't occur as long as you can demonstrate you can hold the security to maturity and there hasn't been effectively an underlying credit event. So if it's due to interest rates, I think you can observe as long as you can hold the security, you'll collect all the cash flows as long as the credit's good.
So that was your view of where practice was before April 2009?
Right,
yeah,
right.
Okay.
So before April 2009, and then the further you get away from it's, you know, a very clear debt-like looking instrument to there's questions about credit, you start getting into this range of the security's been underwater for some period of time. There's no bright lines, but kind of 9 months, 12 months, maybe you ought to start thinking about writing that security off, which is, you know, ironically, or maybe it's not the right word, but, you know, if the crisis starts somewhere in, you know, September 07, by the middle of 08, people are very concerned about whether they have other than temporary impairments, because now you're at about that 9 to 12 month level where securities have been underwater, and people are saying, look, some very legitimately saying, I think this is still temporary, notwithstanding that the security's been underwater for some reasonable period of time, but I don't feel like I have necessarily that objective evidence that would say the accounting literature is looking for to say I don't have to write it off. So the battle became, the question often became, when do I have to write down these other than temporarily impaired securities? With a lot of tension, so to your point on is it causing deleveraging, I don't know, but I think it was a lot of focus on it will either have potential impact of deleveraging or require a bank to raise capital because of the interrelationship between bank capital standards and accounting standards. So if you use that as the starting point for measuring, you know, bank capital at the point in time which you write something down, suddenly you have either a, you know, big capital deficit or, you know, you got to go raise capital.
Right.
Maybe just a slight digression here into this, to the issue of when you use fair value accounting, because that seems to be a little bit of what's at stake here, it seems to me. Firms making a decision to choosing a held for trading or available for sale as opposed to hold to maturity.
Right.
And that sort of cross-linked with the issue of what kind of securities are they treating that way. I mean, you got equities traded on the New York Stock Exchange, then you've got a pretty safe price discovery process. If you're doing private placements and you're holding those held for trading or available for sale, then you know that's not as liquid a market. It worked pretty well during normal, pretty well, but it's, in other words,
yeah, I think what kind some of difficulty came in if you had things that were, you know, in hindsight, they're not as liquid because it may not have been a traded security, but they're holding them.
Yeah, there's no secondary market at all, and you're allowed to hold them as. I guess they're held. Those kind of instruments would be available. The temporary impairment would only apply to available for sale and not to held for trading.
Held for trading or trading securities are just marked up and down
through the P&L currently.
Each period.
But you probably wouldn't have held your your structured securities as that. You would have held them and available for sale.
Yeah, except some of the investment banks are all a trading.
I think it's hard to say.
So for them, there was no decision.
Right.
I mean, I think it depends on the strategy of the company, and it depends on, you know, how aggressive they want to be with classifying things into trading versus held to maturity, and then everything else is in available for sale.
Well, that's what I was getting at. For the broker dealers, they're required. Everything is marked to market, and it goes to the P&L, right?
Right.
But for banks, they had the discretion, and those are the ones that seem to be having a problem. What's the guidelines on that? I mean, can these guys? Is it just it's my business model that I'm going to hold the liquid securities as available for sale, or even possible to help for trading, so I can, you know, take those profits up quick early?
Between those two categories, it's pretty much free choice. The category of held to maturity is pretty rigorous. You've got to, you know, one, it's got to be something that actually has a maturity. So for equities, you know, can't hold an equity to maturity. And pretty significant degree of rigor around if you sell instruments out of held to maturity, it taints your ability to make a assertion that you're holding stuff to maturity. But between trading and available for sale, it's basically management strategy.
There's no guidelines on that. It's like that's your discretionary decision.
Yes.
And once you've made that decision, whether it was wise or not,
you stick with it.
Okay, I didn't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Effectively.
And you stick with it. There are some instances I can talk to you offline where companies during the crisis, because they changed their intent because of the how the market was responding, rather than keep their intent as trading, they changed their intent to hold to maturity, and now some of those hold to maturity terms are 10 years. So that's a big business decision if you've made that. That's a significant amount of securities.
So it would be more of a prudential regulatory issue as opposed to an accounting issue to try to come up with guidelines on when to choose one category or another, given the nature of the underlying market for the financial instrument. You wouldn't think of that as an accounting policy.
You wouldn't necessarily. As long as you keep the two categories, it'd be hard to divine kind of a clear line of when one might be in one or one might be in the other. You blend if something's available for sale, you blend pretty quickly into, well, I might be trading that thing. And so I think FASB basically said, look, you know, you can have it in either, with a clear preference over time that trading would be, you know, a better model, or mark-to-market through income would be a better model. But because of that interrelationship with regulatory capital, and this is the piece that, you know, I think particularly as you saw the market become more and more, at least in some people's view, not responding to fundamentals or less and less rational questions about whether the liquidity premium that's being charged is basically an over-response, and because of the interrelationship with regulatory capital, you know, the idea of a permanent impairment seems to be one. So take, for example, if it's just a change in interest rates or a change in liquidity but no change in credit. So you've got a debt security. the thing goes down $1,000, it goes down $100 simply because of changes in liquidity and interest rates. You don't have to write that down to market. There's no time period at which it's underwater if it's available for sale security that you have to recognize that loss in income, as long as you can hold it and collect the cash flows. Now, as soon as there is $1 of, let's say, same security, but there is, you know, I think I'll get $999 of the principal, or and there's a $1 credit impairment, you suddenly have to write it down to $899. And so people were starting to, it puts a lot of pressure on people wanting to say, well, my security isn't credit impaired, because as soon as it is, I take not only the impairment for credit, but I take the impairment for the decline in interest, or this fact pattern might not have been a decline in interest rates, but also the liquidity. Where
so
FASB,
that's a big change in April 9 then.
Yeah, where FASB said when something is other than temporarily impaired, you take the credit impairment through income, but the remainder of the impairment kind of doesn't get recognized until it becomes a credit impairment.
It's treated like available for sale.
Yeah. And you know, to varying degrees of criticism from some saying this was an elimination of mark-to-market or it's a step backwards. We've actually done, FASB at the time did, and we've done subsequently outreach to investors to say, you know, was this as bad as some people said it was up front? There were some groups that said, look, we'll lose information. And I've heard from a number that actually think they get additional insight, because you still have information about the fair value of the security, but you get added information about here's how much of that decline is credit impairment versus, you know, declines due to other factors.
Sorry, as an economist, I can't help asking this question. Okay, so the idea is that once there's a credit event, you remark to market, so you're writing it down to $899, right? Initially, you can avoid the liquidity and interest rate effects, but once there's a credit loss, then it has to be marked back to market, and now it's $8.99. Fine, you move along. Interest rates fall. Liquidity returns. When can you mark it up?
Yeah, so
you have to wait for another credit event to mark it
up? You actually have to wait till you collect the cash. So you don't mark it up. It's
if it's another than temporary impairment, you don't get a mark up.
Well, and this is the bias. So this has been a long-standing bias in accounting that you know, you recognize losses
actually,
when they.
That.
Oh yeah,
it's
no, it's long. It's like into the
more of cost or market before 1994.
It's like in the '50s where.
So you write down
this principle
if the market
of
was below cost. You'd write down to the market, but you couldn't write back up.
This kind of long-standing '50s and maybe even predates that of the accounting being lower of cost or market. And then when you write it down to the lower of those two, that becomes your new carrying amount, and you write it up basically when you realize it, so when you sell the security.
It gives everyone incentives to go back and sell each other's laundry, right?
Oh, yeah. Then you know, you flip it and you recognize my gain. And
So
the writing it down to $899 is actually the piece that FASB changed in April of
09,
yeah. So literally, if there's only $1 of impairment, you'd write it down to $9.99.
So one other thing I wanted to just get your opinion on fair value, and other than temporary impairments, given the, well, let's take fair value separately. Assuming we're in a level 2, or in particular a level 3 category of valuation, there's some level of judgment involved in determining what model do I use, what assumptions do I use. And because of that, it seems as though there's some opportunity for companies, if they want to manage the values that come out of those models within some relatively narrow range. True?
Yeah. I mean, so one of the issues would be consistency of approach. So if you're changing your assumption, you know, what methods do you use, or what model do you use? If economics are changing and so there is a better model, you know, obviously one might want to change to that better model. But if you just don't like the result of a model, you know, questions would be, well, why didn't you like the result? Are you always at the kind of the low end of a range of assumptions, or the high end, or do you, you know, have a process where you look at 3 or 4 indicators and pick the average? But yeah, there's not different really than any estimate that somebody's making for financial reporting, whether it's loan losses or pension pension asset return assumptions, that at some level there is, you know, room for people saying this is a reasonable outcome as, or this is a reasonable input as this. So I think part of what an auditor, in my view, ought to be looking at is, you know, our changes over time, you know, pushing to one end of the scale, not just on fair value, but on, you know, pension discount rates. Mm-hmm. So are you pushing the envelope on every judgment, or you might start getting into, is this being done for earnings management purposes, or is it really being done because these are best estimates?
Okay. And then the same thing, I think, same type of potential ability to manage the outcome comes into play in other than temporary impairments, because it is a highly judgmental decision point when you actually have that other than temporary impairment. But again, the company would have, should have appropriate controls and processes in place,
right,
consistent methodologies, and then the auditor looking over their shoulders too.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. More on fair value?
My only other, what role did it play in the crisis on fair value is, the one thing that was new in Statement 157 was the ability, that combined with a statement called 159, which is titled as Fair Value Option. FASB gave entities the option to elect almost any financial instrument. There's a handful of exceptions, but almost any financial instrument, and account for it based on fair value. And they didn't limit that to the asset side of the balance sheet. They actually said you could fair value your own debt. I personally struggle with whether that's useful financial reporting unless it's accompanied by, you know, fairly significant disclosure to tell investors that gains are being thrown off of this entity because of, you know, worse and worse financial condition leading to, you know, potential for insolvency. And is that really meaningful and useful financial reporting?
Yeah. I owe less because they value my debt less.
Right.
Why can't they just limit that to the, if you actually buy it back and reissue, you get to treat, you get to treat that as a pickup.
So,
but if you can't buy it back and reissue it, then...
But 159, I think of 159 as potentially an opportunity for companies to get effectively the result of applying hedge
match
accounting
strip
without going through the complexities of putting a derivative on and qualifying.
So if it had been limited, if it had been limited to, I could use, and the international standard is I can fair value my debit side or debit my credit side when I've got assets that are basic. So if you thought about a securitization structure or something like that, so there's got to be some linkage. If I got assets and it's more like non-recourse debt, so as the assets go down, the value of my debt goes down. That kind of makes sense. Or if I can monetize it. But
yeah, if it's non-credit risk, that's done it. If it's an interest rate fluctuation, that's lowered the value of your liabilities. Yeah, there's no problem.
Right.
But otherwise, it's like buying puts on yourself. You know, and it market doesn't normally like it when firms go out and buy puts on their own stock. It's not usually considered a good shareholder use of value.
That's
what you'd equivalently done with a derivative if you wanted to lower the cost of your liability side. So you're betting against yourself. And that's not normally thought of as a hedge so much as just a...
Right.
My view is
unanimously shared here, but I find it challenging as to whether or not that's... you know, extremely useful financial reporting.
So that was a fascinating phenomenon in 08. I think Citigroup and JP Morgan had recorded $3 billion, $5 billion gains on their,
right,
their liabilities.
Did
that actually get written back up when the value of their debt went up? I mean, how does that play out?
Yeah, so it does. Mm-hmm. If the value goes up, it gets written back up.
Mm-hmm. So their credit rating improves and they get expense and their credit rating.
I don't think it was credit ratings. It's not based on ratings. It was just based on the fact that their debt was down in the market, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, it might be indirectly
so they
credit rate. You know, as credits go up, they go up. Or,
yeah.
But yeah, it's literally floating with your best estimate of the market. In some cases, pretty observable, you know, trades. But again, I question. I get if it's really offsetting an exposure, that why people want to do that. I struggle if it's not offsetting an exposure. Whether
I could see it with not having with the derivative fair value accounting, you have to really link the instrument to derivative, which as all the pension fund people I've talked to said, that's a huge headache. And if they could just do it on a portfolio basis, they'd be all so much more efficient and happier. And I don't,
have a problem with that. I have a problem with the dimension of it, that that credit dimension is what you ought not to be writing down it, because that's the part that's not economically coherent in a sense. Whereas even on a portfolio basis, the other types of risk would be coherent. You know, so you could balance your whole interest rate sensitivity of your asset side with a matching interest rate sensitivity of the liability side. And that seems, that you sort of want to encourage that.
Counter argument be that if I have to take credit into effect on my asset side, I ought to be able to take credit into effect on my liability side.
Yeah, and I think, and I get
credits you on the liability side. The credit is somebody else on the asset side. And so it's hard for you to take credit for a decline in your own deteriorating credits.
I just take a step back and say, if you can't monetize it, how is that useful to...
Yeah.
Particularly an equity investor, so I'm showing big gains in income that have nothing to do with the equity investor ever going to be realizing anything if it's your own credit. I mean, this gets extinguished in bankruptcy, and so I lost everything, but at least the entity show a lot of gains.
Yeah, if you're sitting on cash, they mark your credit rating down to nothing. You can buy your own debt back. Then, yeah, take
that. Beautiful. I'll go buy it back, and the equity holder just
in fact,
got
they did
you know,
that,
a windfall.
I remember with all the Brady bonds. All the Latin American countries brought their baby bonds back, and because they had enough cash to do it, and that accounting makes sense to me if you could, as you say, monetize it. But otherwise, it's
a pretty polarizing topic in accounting circles.
Yeah, I thought it was crazy when I first saw it, but I've kind of gotten a little numb to it. I guess
I have a little. I mean, as long as you get enough disclosure. But to me, it's why do you know if the accounting needs to be compensated by hey, beware, there's a bunch of gains that you should probably disregard.
Yeah,
then you might start thinking about, you know, do I have the right accounting?
Yeah.
But I don't. Other than you can find a handful of companies that took large gains, usually fairly transparently, because there were Wall Street Journal stories talking about these institutions that were failing, throwing off big gains. So I don't think that it played, you know, a significant role in the crisis. It's just one that I think is worth mentioning about. Is it?
Phenomenon. Yeah. So I'm sure people were raving at how great our county standards were when they saw those big gains come through. So
if you're moving on to something else,
yes.
We need to take a brief break if we can do
sure.
That, so we can show you where it is.
Okay.
Jim, are you okay?
Yeah, fine.